we got the second session on today. Kirk, about the perils of benchmarking.
Right. So I'll start the session by saying I don't really have anything prepared for it, honestly. It's the first day session. I'll lie. I'll say I don't have anything useful to say about benchmarking. But I thought I saw a couple people in the room that do have something to say about benchmarking, so I thought I'd suggest the topic just to make sure that I could learn from them some of the perils of benchmarking, and maybe we can share like war stories and talk about different things. There's probably a couple of different things to talk about. I think probably the most underrated aspect of the underrated aspects of benchmarking, I think that we talk about one, test harnesses. We've just recently had a nice discussion on test harnesses. It finally came up with a term for something that I've been seeing in benchmarks for years, right? This idea of omission and coordinated omission that Gil Tenneth started talking about. And that's one aspect. The other aspect of it is, how should I say it, interpretation of results. And there's a whole statistical side to that story, and there's also a whole interpretation side to that story, and there's a whole how do we take measurement side to that story, and there's just, so many sides to that story that, it's probably got more dimensions than the universe. That's one aspect of it, and, the other aspect of it is how difficult is it to really get a benchmark to actually function, or better yet, how many broken benchmarks are we actually looking at and making decisions from, which is probably, in my experience, well, I'll put it this way. My experience with spec is pretty much every benchmark I've run from them is measuring something that I don't think they ever intended to be actually measuring. The worst case, I would say, is the SpecJMS, which I quickly discovered was actually measuring disk drive speed more than anything else. And you can talk about the other aspects of some of the huge mistakes that Spec has made in terms of what they've done in terms of setting up these very elaborate benchmarks that, at the end of the day, no one has a real clue as to what they're actually measuring. So,
could I propose a quick question? Who actually finds spec benchmarks useful?
They're very entertaining. Your guys found them actually useful.
Well, some of them did, yes. I personally.
Well, because it was a big marketing baseball bat that they used to beat over the head of some of your competitors. Mm-hmm.
From an end user's perspective, from someone who actually uses any of this stuff, does anyone actually read those benchmarks, find them useful, make any decisions based on them?
I look at specint. That's about it. Specint.
Okay.
Specint.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's discuss how that's broken.
Yes, it is, but it's about as far as I get into it.
Okay. Specint. So you don't find any of the spec benchmarks useful?
Good job.
Personally, no, like I said, I'm wondering what other people are.
So that means you're losing the marketing war on the benchmarks right now?
The marketers love it. I'm not a marketing guy.
Yeah, I am.
That's all I can say.
I was just really kidding.
I think this leads to the point, why do people do benchmarking? So it's just, most of the time it's because of marketing, so that my product is better than the other one.
I don't find that to be the case, though. The marketing guys do all their benchmarks because they want to prove. And as I like to describe it, right? The difference between technical people benchmarking or for production or marketing benchmarks is that you're going to measure, some unit of work through some fixed window of time, and as you benchmark, something bad is going to happen, right? Whatever bad is. And the thing is, with the marketing benchmarks, you want to make the window so big and then tune the system in such a way that you push the bad thing to happen outside of the window. Right? And then for a useful production, acceptance benchmark or something like that, it really behooves you to set the benchmark up so that bad thing happens within your window of test so that you can understand what it is, so that you can investigate and react to the, know how the system is going to react to that, and you know, possibly what you can do to prevent it, or at least mitigate the effects of that bad thing happening if you can't prevent it from happening. And that's really the, I think the big difference between marketing. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like with spec. What do you do with spec, right?
It is a marketing benchmark. It's not
one. You got a like 1 hour test window. You can just push that full GC event outside that 1 hour bench window, right? So that it doesn't interfere with your BBOPs or whatever silly measurement they've come up with. That.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
I remember from computer architecture book from university, the comment on peak performance, because this issue goes back a long way, is that peak performance is a manufacturer's guarantee not to exceed a certain rating. And you still see that today. It's like, it's almost like there is one extreme use case where this is the fastest thing it can do, and that's pretty much your guarantee. That's going to be your upper bound in terms of performance, not
right. So I don't know. Maybe do you want to instead of having me talk all the time, one of you guys want to describe the coordinated omission problem that Gil was describing?
Sure. Give it a go.
Yeah.
The problem people get in systems, especially a synchronous request response type system, is you want to measure percentiles. But what percentage or what quantile of a number of your tasks fail into a certain response range? And the coordinated omission problem is where I'm sending in a request once a second and I'm measuring the system and my response time is coming back typically at 500 millis or something. Simple example like that. What happens if I get a pause that takes 10 seconds? You record one event that took 10 seconds. But what you missed is 9 other events that weren't sent because you didn't send any events. So whenever you track your quantiles, you've actually missed those requests that should have gone into the system. They should have been added to your measurement. So people run around saying, my 99% is this, but actually it's not. It's much worse. And even whenever you ask, so coordinated omission is like, how do I backfill those? But even at that, I think you're only even touching the surface of how bad your system really is. Like some of these measurements are really how good your system is in the best case, not even close to worst case.
Yeah, so I like to look at coordinated omission is that there's some interaction between your test harness and your server that's causing your test harness to miss sending samples to sending requests to the server. And the side, there's a couple of side effects. First off, your request rates are going to be lower than what you think they are, and that's taking pressure off of the server, right? So it's essentially allowing it to recover from whatever the condition is so that things can resume. So it's like a hiccup or something like that. Where the other side of the coin is you just have a mission, or you just have a bad test harness that's not able to keep a load up on a server no matter what. So I have a slide with this about this in my performance tuning course where we talk about, you know, what happens with the effects of test harnesses on, you know, application load and stuff like that and what you can find because of that. And I think what you find is that when you get this condition with coordinated omission or omission, that response times now become asymptotic to some level that's defined by the level of load that can be effectively driven by your test harness, as opposed to being open-ended by just being able to just push load on the system until you either you've saturated it or you've broken it or done something like that to it, right? And the thing is, you find different things when you become asymptotic to some level of, to some artificial level, or if you're allowed to push like beyond that artificial level. There's just different things you're going to see in the system, right? You're going to break different things. Different things are going to become important from a performance perspective, where you might want to focus your tuning. So there's, you know, it just gives you a completely different perspective on a system in those cases.
Simple way to change. I mean, there are ways to fix this properly, but the simplest change that I found that will show this up is instead of using a timestamp when you send the message, use the timestamp of when it should have sent it. So you start your thing, you say, I'm going to send every, 100 milliseconds, And then you, the timestamp that goes out is the timestamp it should have been sent, not when you actually sent it. So if you've got any delays in your system, they show up. It could be a delay in your test harness, like you say. It could be a delay in some sort of feedback. And the reason why a lot of people don't do that is it produces terrible results in many cases. You'd be amazed. Because basically, what happens is if you're queuing or whatever isn't keeping up, your results just shoot off.
I think it goes further than that. So if you do what you're saying, the problem that I see quite often is test harnesses don't inject enough in the first place.
That's correct.
So yes, say you get a GC pause in your test harness, that becomes much worse. So
they can't keep up.
Whenever I've been pushing finance systems, I find that make test harnesses incredibly simple so they can run as fast as possible. So they don't do any of the timing at all. Yeah. And for example, time on the wire. So you use network capture. So you have test harnesses, have multiple of them, because that will even cover for individual ones having issues. It could be for not just Java issues, but lots of OS issues as
right.
well.
Yeah.
Have them running as fast as they should be running at, then do network capture. And you can use hardware that can capture and timestamp the packets as they're actually coming off the wire in the card itself, and you don't miss anything.
And that's good for these like simple type of transactions. But if you get into like broader testing, like with larger, more complex systems, with a very heterogeneous like usage, then those types of things become, so I'd say, a lot more difficult to do. In that case, you're pretty much going to have to rely on the test harness giving you the measurement. Unfortunately, it's going to be a practical reality of life, I think.
In these situations.
You know.
But either way, you still want to make sure that the packets coming out use the start time as your best possible time, your expected time it should.
Right. I think I like that idea, but I don't think it's enough, because it still means that I still have a problem in my test harness. I need to go back and start trying to fix my test harness, rather than these are measurements that I want to use to report on.
Yes.
It's a dirty experiment, because you're measuring your test harness as well as the system.
That's right. Yeah. But you're including everything. And
right.
Only
okay.
when that final number is good that you've
okay.
got some confidence.
So in this case, the question is, how do we measure what constitutes a good measure? And, since we have a lot of statistical variability in the measure anyways, how precise does a measurement, or how accurate does a measurement have to be before it's good enough to do the job, right? So, in other words, we're not going to get it perfect. How close to perfect do we need it, and what type of measurements can we take to say how close to that we're close enough to perfect, or the other thing.
The general, it's not a precise thing, but the general test that I use is how reproducible is it. If the number isn't reproducible, then it's not very good. You didn't run enough tests, or some other problem with your
system. So that's good for precision, but doesn't really say anything about accuracy then, right?
If it's reproducible, then it's hopefully reproducible in production as well. And so that's then the number that you should expect to get.
It's realistic.
So
if it's not a reproducible number, you run the test, you get one number, you run the test, you get a different number, then you've got a problem.
But what happens if you have reproducible numbers that are not accurate?
That's true. You're not testing the right thing.
Right, okay. And that's another issue, too.
Usually there's a separation between business logic and infrastructure, and we conflate those concerns together far too much in the systems we build.
Mm-hmm.
So the things I like to do is build the business model on its own, test that, and see what that can give, then do the infrastructure, and you can replace the business logic with an OAuth that basically just does an echo.
That way
I can more, because like in any given test, good science is changing one variable at a time. We're quite often testing far too many variables being changed.
And then
to take your type of test, if you've done the infrastructure test and the business logic test separately, when you're testing the business logic remotely, you can actually accurately remove what is the cost of the test harness at that stage.
As long as coordinated omission isn't involved.
Yes.
And that really comes into integration testing then. You have to test all the bits together. But definitely, if your test harness is bad from the beginning, then everything else is all.
I think it's building up things. At first, then, I used to talk about this well, but Peter described it really well in the talk I've seen recently. Is you can't go back and retrofit some of the stuff very easily, because it's a bit like I have a chemical soup. how do I work out what's in that? It's just really, really difficult. Which is much easier to start off with here. I have got a clean solution, now I'm going to start adding things one by one and watching the effects of things one by one as I add them, I can then work it out. I think that's right. I'd like a separate talk on how we actually make performance tuning part of the continuous delivery of what we do. Because otherwise, feedback cycles, so as soon as you break it, you know straight away.
Yeah.
You try to take apart a suit later on, it's just
it's
impossible.
Really difficult. Yeah.
It is very, very hard.
Yeah. So one of the discussions I've been having over the last couple of years has to, again, do with like what I call a coordinated mission. That's nice having a term. You know, I think vocabulary is also very important, and the problem with performance is that there's not a the vocabulary is ill-defined, but that's another topic altogether. But with coordinated mission, we've been for a couple of years been talking to Apache people about how their threading model sets them up for really bad coordinated mission, and as you know, the real problem is they started off with this really naive implementation for the tooling, which means they have like one thread per user, right? So it's just like the old web servers before you had thread pooling, right? As opposed to maybe going to some event-based, you know, thread pool type style model, which is obviously much more difficult to implement. But when you get into these situations, right, where you need to have like high thread counts to drive reasonable amounts of load against your application, then you're really setting yourself up for, you know, for failures.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah. So it took about 2 years for the Apache guys to, you know, completely understand that. But we just went in and looked at the threading model that they're using, you know, and how they're supporting
Apache
that.
Project business?
Sorry?
Which Apache project?
Apache JMeter. I mean, I tend to try to promote that project because it gets people from zero to something, generally within, you know, an hour or so. So it's a good way to get going. And quite frankly, if you look at, like, Gatling or, you know, Grindr or all of the other open source load generating or, you know, injector tools that are out there, they all suffer from the same threading problem. They all suffer from this very naive threading model. And, you know, it's another point we say is like, you know, a threading model is okay if you're dealing with a closed system, but more often than not, we're not dealing with closed systems, we're dealing with open systems, right? Difference between closed systems and open systems is an example I often give is like, if you're modeling a call center, that's a closed system. Right, but if you're modeling like just a web app, that's an open system, and this is where you start getting these situations where you've architected your testing correctly, so that you start getting like I guess erroneous results from, well, one way to get erroneous results from the benchmark. Yeah. So anyways, so after 2 years, they finally looked at their threading model, and they just realized that. They hadn't really followed good separation concerns or good layering or, you know, basically good architecture. And there were so many couplings between what they're doing and, you know, the rest of Apache JMeter that is pretty much, it was basically a rewrite to change the threading model from what they had to something like a little bit more reasonable.
I found that went even further when I profiled it. I was benchmarking web application sending financial market data as events over Comet.
Right.
And we just couldn't get anywhere near the load that we expected the system to drive. And we knew that the system could generate much more just from our unit tests that we're hitting it, but something felt wrong.
Right.
We kept profiling, we tried all the different ones, didn't work. And I just, as a sidestep, tried Apache Bench, the C program, running scripts, running bash scripts, and I could drive more load from bash scripts than I could from JMeter.
Yeah, and that's just simply because you got into a different threading model in that case.
Well, it wasn't just the threading model. After profiling, the threading model was part of the problem. A much bigger part of the problem was the HTTP parsing. Using URL connection and the HTTP client,
yeah,
was so slow.
Sucks in.
We were adding our own thread pool with our own HTTP client, and at the time we were using Couchshow Resin. And I know Scott Ferguson, who implemented that quite well, and his internal benchmarks weren't getting anywhere near close, or his marks were so further apart from what JMeter was saying was possible. It looked like Tomcat and Resin were kind of similar. And it was because that's what JMeter said they could do, not what they could actually do. we've seen it go from a few hundred requests a second through our different implementation up to 40,000 requests a second. Just all of a sudden, and it was nothing to do with Resin. The whole problem was Jeremy here.
Right.
And tracing it down into URL connection and HTTP client.
Yeah.
By just rewriting our own HTTP parsing. It's been a massive difference.
And this is a problem I've seen in a lot of client sites. So they're so focused on their application, they're looking at it and say, we should be able to do this transactional rate, and we're not getting there, and it's like, why, right? And they're not looking behind them to see where their test harness is and what load it's able to drive on the systems, right? So as soon as you like look backwards and say, oh, that's the problem over there, you know, then all of a sudden you can come up with creative solutions to deal with it. But, you know, the problem is you need to see it before you're going to be able to...
I think the world changed a bit, and people didn't see it. When we had request response, you had think time of humans, like 5-10 seconds or whatever, and something like GenMeter generating events on that sort of order across all logical one, that was kind of okay. But you said before, that was good enough.
That was good enough, yeah.
Now we've got comment applications that are pushing events really, really fast out, or people writing web services or anything else that's automated touching those, the think time now is now down to milliseconds. In many cases, and those tools like Jeremy, they just don't cope anymore.
No, they not only don't cope, they become actually the bottleneck in your test system. Mm. And when they become the bottleneck in the test system, that's going to, you know, that's the dominant behavior in your system. And so it's just going to mask anything else that's happening anywhere else in the other parts of you where you're looking for something. So,
When you're tuning a system, the first thing you should tune is your test times.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first thing you need to do is you need to check it. Test it, make sure that you can drive the load you want, and make sure that it's not interfering.
First client I ever had, I improved their performance of their benchmarks by a factor of 10 by changing the benchmark.
Yeah, then you know there's that's bad.
That's pretty bad. And then with a couple of, only after they fixed it though, it was just a couple of lines of code to give them another factor of 2. So they'd already gone from a factor of 20 times by fixing the benchmark and changing just a few lines of code.
How do you get people to the point of knowing what's possible? I find that an interesting exercise. They look at a system and go, that does 600 requests a second, that's good.
Yeah,
I think it's good. It's twice as good as the last system.
That's why I called my company higher frequency trading, because it's always a bit better than the last one. It's usually what we have to do. Yes, I think the best example is someone using Google App Engine on Stack Overflow. He said, I'm getting 2 to 3 requests a second. Is that good?
Ooh.
And just didn't know whether that was good or not. Because they wanted 20 requests a second, so we're going to have to put in 10 servers to handle it.
but it really comes into this whole thing is that people stop estimating like how much work should be done in order to complete a particular...
Yeah.
transaction, and then understanding, taking that information and understanding, well, first off in Java, you have to understand, okay, what the hell is the JIT going to do and to all this code, how it's going to mangle it up, and then the quickly understanding, okay, how much hardware do I need to actually support this, or if I have this much hardware, how much is it going to consume, and what are the latencies involved, trying to satisfy this particular request, so that you can then build up a model that says, okay, I should be able to get this much amount of work out of this particular system. And then it becomes the next question becomes easy, right? It's like debuggable questions, right? I'm not getting there. Now why?
But also just having an idea of a factor of 10 as to how long something should take. Just having a vague idea. I mean, your benchmarks are not terribly accurate, but or even estimates, but sometimes people will be doing things like, I'm reading a million files. Should I be using buffered input stream or buffered reader? They're sort of like, they're looking at some incredibly small micro-tuning when in fact the obvious thing is, my hard drives won't spin any faster if I use more threads, things like that.
Yeah, well, that comes into the wonderful world of micro-benchmarking, which wasn't sure I wanted to touch on at all, because that's just a beast unto itself, right?
Kind of.
I mean, we have this wonderful
new test harness put out by the Oracle people, which is what they call it, micro.
Java micro benchmark harness.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the guys who wrote that, I know them, and they're incredibly brilliant. Quite often, to get normal people, normal developers to understand, you have to slow them down by a factor of 10 and sort of dumb down their vocabulary by about another factor of 100. You know, it's still, I don't know, it just seems that I haven't seen a micro benchmark, or shall we say, I haven't seen a group of micro benchmarks that I would benefit from a framework. They all seem to need something special around them in order, well, essentially what you're doing is you're always, in this case, trying to trick the JIT compiler to do what you want it to do as opposed to what it thinks it might have to do under these micro conditions, right? So, you know, I've never seen a framework that I can actually manage all the tricks that I'm going to need to employ in order to get this useless benchmark to work.
Essentially, what's going on there, Alex Hitchcock, that is one of the hotspot performance engineers and the main contributor to the framework, is basically working in a team depending on which project he works on. And he does a JIT, he basically destroys the GMH. Then he goes and fixes GMH because the JIT now becomes smarter and optimizes some stuff that he was fighting against.
Right,
so
that's good for him.
Yeah, basically, yeah, cool. It's working against itself.
But what about us average humans?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, yeah, when you're writing micro benchmarks, I mean, there's so much going on under the hood. And if you don't understand, like, you write the code and it's that code's eliminated, like, you're measuring nothing, like, wow, Java is like billion times faster than C++, like, we're going to write a blog post or something.
Yeah.
But in fact, the benchmark is basically screwed.
I've got these loops that take me 50th of a nanosecond.
Exactly. So basically what you're trying to do with that thing is
and a network call that takes 5 seconds.
kind of fight against the most common, you know, mistakes of, like, not returning a value or something, like capturing the state, and there's the concept of a black hole. It's like a set of clauses, basically, with a very deep inheritance tree, so to kill all the JIT implementations in line and whatnot. And this kind of thing hooks underneath your benchmark and kind of sucks down your values, so the JIT cannot do anything. So you're actually measuring the workload or the code you're trying to micro-benchmark. So this kind of interesting, but yeah, I don't know how good it is. I've never used it. But
and as an aside, doesn't, like, all of this discussion make the idea of, like, costing a piece of code by just looking at the Java source, like, ridiculous?
Yeah.
Yeah, as a slight aside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like all of the cost models that you learned in university, they're now all incorrect.
Yeah.
They're all wrong. Yeah. Or they need to be altered by each of the levels of machinery that's, like, below it.
Mm. I think the only ones that really stand out are the big O's. You get, you know, if you put order n squared, it's still going to be generally slower than order n, so if n's larger, things like that. But apart from that, there's, you know, a lot of it just goes out the window.
Well, a naive look will see when that doesn't quite work. If you look at certain JVM languages, like the Scala and whatever, which will unwind to reversions and things like that, which on the first hand will look very expensive, will not be as expensive.
Yeah, if you look at some of the stuff coming up in Lambdas, like, they looked incredibly expensive.
Right, and
right?
It's not really one system.
Right, but as soon as you put a splitterator underneath the hood there, all of a sudden, you know, things change, right? Yeah, it's a bit of an aside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you guys, you sent a couple of guys off for benchmark.
A couple of the protocols or something?
Yeah, for benchmark training. Do you find there's some different attitudes towards benchmarking?
Well, the attitude's already always been there. That's always been kind of driven within the team. I mean, any real changes yet? Not really, but that happens soon enough. The guys just be busy with stuff.
Just curious, but how much do you rely on benchmarking for all the work you do?
Quite a bit, actually. Yeah, we don't quite have. I want to get to the point where we are doing continuous benchmarking,
right?
Continuous performance testing, as we're talking about. It's not quite there yet, but yeah, that is going to happen. So right now, it's very much, like I said, analyzing that chemical soup at the end, sort of thing, which is not fun. Yeah.
I think having the test, there's a really nice safety net. So I think the really good example last year was the hash map change. One of my clients got really badly bitten with saving the hash maps. And we designed this whole application really carefully to make sure there was no contention. Not suddenly a parallel slow down. But the benchmarks showed it straight away.
Right.
And so we tracked it down. And it comes down to you start parsing any hierarchical data, you need to create maps.
Yeah.
And the creation of the maps was killing this. But for everybody else who didn't have benchmarks in place, they just went, wow, it just got slower.
Right.
I've updated the JDK, it's got a bug, it's slower. That's just regress.
And no one knows.
And then there's one forward. I've seen some banks that haven't moved forward to JDK for 2 years after being bitten once like that. They just, we just don't upgrade anymore.
And that's actually terrible. That's what holds everything back.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. It's an interesting comment that you made earlier, Martin, about fixing JMeter in a sense. Not really fixing it, but you're writing your own threading model and your own HTTP parsers for that. Was that in the context of JMeter, or was it something completely separate?
Completely separate. We're building our own load testing tools,
okay.
And we wanted to write as little code as possible, so let's pick up what we can. And we were just stunned at how bad everything was in the space. We just tool after tool after tool.
It was
just riddled with really, really simple mistakes.
Well, the reason why I asked is because I mean, whether this, if this really was a patch to JMeter, an extension to JMeter or whatever, has it actually been gone back?
This is a complete rewrite. We had to just approach it in a completely
For Apache to fix the problems they have with JMeter, they're going to have to do a complete rewrite.
Yes, you were saying,
So we found it independently the same, come to the same conclusion. The test harnesses are all just pathetically bad. But, I mean, if you're starting with nothing and you need to get someplace, I think JMeter is a good option. Writing your own test harness is a non-trivial activity.
Yeah.
Because there's so many of these things that you have to think about. I mean, if it was a trivial activity, these JMeter guys wouldn't have made the number of mistakes that they made. And it's almost like caching, right? On the surface, it's just a big cache gap, right? It sounds very simple. Right, but it's only when you start looking at the details you realize that it is simple. No, I mean, it's
I actually ended up writing my own test harness as well for distributed caches, just because there was nothing that would actually drive load in a distributed way for a distributed system in VM for each node and all of that, and tooling around that to be able to collate results. And
we actually have our QA people write their own stuff. And I realized the soft factor kind of works neatly, because when something sucks the phones, why do they blame us? So we look at it,
right.
And sometimes they're right, and sometimes we blame them. Saying,
sure,
sorry,
sure.
The bottleneck you're looking for is in your code, not in ours. So you can fix that, and you come back later.
I
find another bottleneck.
I've actually had the experience of benchmarking Terracotta's first implementations.
So you're talking about VSO stuff back then?
Yeah, and I have to say that it took a long time. It was about a year and a half exercise, and over time, because I was breaking everything in the implementation.
Let's not talk about this whole VSO stuff. I think it's still the most brilliant idea since sliced bread, personally.
Yeah,
but
I think so too.
Making it happen.
Is very, very difficult.
And it's a thing in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. But I completely agree with you. I mean, it really, you really get a really good sense of what caching is and what replication is when you start using something that actually works that way.
How about kind of interesting look? The library that performs. I know by a couple of Martin talks, there's this thing about logging frameworks.
There's
an initiative which Martin's part of. Can you talk about this new whole thing about, let's say it started in the financial space and it's kind of sponsored by financial institutions, that's about open source and
so
space things?
Hopefully it can help. And I built a project called Lodestone, and it's got a number of the banks looking at sponsoring a new open source initiative to build software that's useful, particularly in high performance into the capital markets. At the moment, it's been a huge exercise in trying to get the legal departments of multiple banks working together, which I'm not going to go into. So that's why it hasn't happened so far. But we are making progress. It's just pretty glacial. It may or may not happen this year.
Sorry, what's the goal of this?
to build software that's common across these organizations.
Or just general components.
Yeah, but specifically for, you know, the high performance, which means that they have the special problem, well, that which you're all aware of, but maybe these guys aren't. It's like, you know, you don't want to create objects, right, at all, if you possibly avoid it, which means that you can't use a lot of frameworks because they create a lot of objects.
Or they all use Log4j internally.
Right. Which is probably one of the worst logging frameworks ever invented, except for all of the rest.
Log4j 2.
Let's not go there.
You've got to start strong. You've got to get started on something.
They're just, you know, pathetically bad. And you have a Java Chronicle.
That's right. Well, that's what I use for logging, not surprisingly, since I have Redshift. Yeah, and that works particularly well, particularly because it can replay. So it's a binary format. You can make it text, but most people seem to use binary. And but it's also it's easily replayed because it's designed to be used for IPC, so it can be replayed by any number of consumers. And it's good for reproducing tests or synchronizing, say, test with production. So you've got production, replicate all your inputs into a state machine in test. You could show your test systems are doing the same things or doing the right things,
right?
As the system's really running.
So that was your lightning talk for that.
Yep. That's one of the.
So back to benchmark and maybe some of the statistics and measurements. What I find is like a lot of systems are like not really Gaussian, or they're really like bimodal or multimodal, in the sense that you have a mix of different signals coming into the data. And then we take an average of that. And really, you know, so we're using Gaussian statistics for like to try to measure things that are inherently non-Gaussian. And, you know, so you see like a complete lack of the use of simple things like histograms and, you know, basically frequency models to help you understand what's going on in your system, especially if you get in situations where, I mean, the one I always like to say is like, you know, if TCP works wonderfully, everything goes out, back, you get a response time, right? But if you go out and you don't get the back, then you get the out again, and maybe you get the out again. So you get things that happen like, you know, it worked or it didn't work, and there's like nothing in between, you know? So you get the system that's bimodal, and now we take the average, right? It's equivalent of saying that, on average, people have less than two legs.
The average family in the UK has 2.3 children.
Not to offend anybody, but...
And the UK families have 2.3 children.
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's a slightly different problem, but you can see that it's
multimodal.
Right, it's sort of this multimodal situation. And so we always like to advocate using different types of measures or different ways of looking at the data, because these ways of looking at the data are actually going to expose things that just a pure average. If I look at a benchmark and all you publish is an average, I stop looking. You know, to me that benchmark is pretty useless, because I can't really tell anything about the quality of the data or anything about the quality of measurements or the spreads or anything. I really need to know the shape of the data, not just the average. Yeah.
It'd be an interesting question for anyone in production systems. Who actually monitors QLens, keeps metrics, keeps running figures per second, dumped, anything like that
in systems running?
The production is way more interesting. Who actually has any measurements from the production system that are useful like that? There's a few. So we actually built this inside the tool, because when I heard about like the raw metrics and everything and all this benchmarking war on they're going through, I think it's basically all bullshit.
Right.
I don't really care about all this. But being able to track exactly the figures, like the shape of the data coming in and stuff. So we actually tried to put a bunch of efforts, and so for all known safety, right, when you put the thing in production, so that we can see how the product performs like in that environment, based on a bunch of things, and just sometimes you just.
Well, you know, I read some article recently about, you know, basically how to tie this type of data back into understanding what your constraining resource is, and then how to balance, you know, thread balance, of, you know, the system so that you don't like oversubscribe to whatever the constraining resource is in your system, because quite often it's not CPU, it's like something else that's constraining. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, getting these numbers out of a system, especially with queues or anything like that, is critical. You can't do anything without it.
Yeah.
You know? And then you have to understand the queuing theory behind it a little bit, and a high-level hand wave so that you take the numbers and be able to do something interesting with them afterwards. But, you know, but first we need guys like you guys to get the numbers into the product to begin with.
Yeah, and we also realized measuring stuff, we also were queuing things, so we just did a huge rewrite of the whole way we gather statistics in the product, because we're human, we need space.
Yeah, sure.
So. Fix those, but yeah, and really helps, right? We find then bugs, whatever they are, technically in our product, sometimes like using the wrong kernel on the machine from the scheduler, performance goes down the drain. The other way around, like bottlenecks in the user app. So, but we need to look at the whole picture. It doesn't work. I don't buy into all this stuff. Obviously, we can all queue our benchmarks, tune our benchmarks so that our product looks good. If we're not able to do this, we should stop being in our business.
Well, those are really benchmarks. Most of the marketing folks.
But, yeah, so they're kind of fun with that.
Yeah. But some simple things, like you take the basic queues that we get inside JDK, like a rev locking queue, link locking queue, or a concurrent link queue, getting the size of any of those, with two of them are locked, another one's an order in.
Mm-hmm.
Operation to work out the size of your queues. If you don't know the size of your queues into any of your work pools, how can you predict response times of the system?
You can't.
You can't apply little flow to anything that's going on. And so fundamentally, we argue that Lambda's algorithm about everything else. It is trivial to change those three queue implementations to add the ability to get size as an order one operation mm-hmm. that's not locked.
Yeah,
and it's not done.
The last article I wrote for InfoQ was basically writing an MX beam over the executor, right? Thread exec. So the question is like, why is that not in there in the JDK to begin with? Because if you're using these things in your implementations, you need to know this information to understand, you know, how to, you know, tune that particular. Mm-hmm. Without it, you're basically, as I say, pissing into the wind, right?
Yeah. Well, like if you've got like second samples of all of your queue lengths, and you're just tracking those. It's such invaluable information.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, the peaks are really useful too. Because
mm-hmm.
your second samples might miss an unusual peak.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. That really goes into another thing we're talking about, like when we're talking about are your profilers lying to you and sampling and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I'll leave that for when we actually get to that subject.
Yes, because
right?
People write their own profilers into
we'll go back to benchmarking and stuff like that.
Yeah, you want to write benchmarks that show all of your weaknesses, which isn't necessarily what you want marketing people want to hear, but you want to help use it to help you find issues with your system. And to make it clear where the issue is when it happens, rather than to hide it away and make it look good, because it's very easy to do.
Somebody else will tell them the problem.
Another problem we run into is I'll call it a data light. Right, and essentially what it means is like having production volumes and production quality of data, not only to feed your test, but also to drive the test. And this comes into, predictability, it comes into caching, it comes into even, if the JIT is exercised, you know, we have benchmarks, right, that says return true. It's faster than returning false. We have benchmarks that say, hey, returning false is faster than returning true, right? So, you know, what's obviously right here? Well, what's obviously right is that there's somebody's in there and he's making some measurements and he's predicting what you're going to do and he's going to use that prediction to fast path, you know, what's going on or do some other under the hood trick to otherwise optimize something for the particular runtime conditions that you're working in. And what we find is that if you're running in like what we call data light situations where you don't have enough quality production data, either feeding the system or putting pressure on the system from the front end, that you get into these like false optimizations that can really cause caching and stuff to really speed things up and make things look a lot better than what they are, and you know, other issues. I don't know if anybody's like run into these situations where you deploy and all of a sudden performance sucks.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's come across that. It's just, there's so many different reasons why that can happen. That's one.
Yeah. Well, I find this is a big one actually, because you find this happens quite often. Is that, you know, something gets fully cached or something gets sucked in, or even if you're just driving with a very small subset of data from the user's point of view, from the client point of view, that it, the system's going to cache that part of the data that's being utilized. Right, and not, and just ignore the other terabyte of data that you have nicely lined up in your database, or whatever other data source you have.
I still find the biggest misleading thing over there is when people test with a particular type of data, like
right.
shape, and then in real life it's very heterogeneous, and there are all sorts of different things coming in, and the system just aren't tuned for that. Because they tuned it for one particular type of class, for example, to handle one particular type of class.
And you don't get the right type of contention
That's
in your
good.
System, right? Then, I mean, really what we're talking about is like finding contention in the system.
Yeah. I mean, one very good example is within Finispan, at least, one of the biggest places to tune things is your network stack. And people will happily tune TCP buffers and everything else to a particular type of object that they're interacting with in their test suite. And once it goes live, the shape of data changes completely, and then suddenly all the assumptions they made are completely wrong.
Another thing that I see, particularly in the low latency space, is assuming that you can run through it under load and expect to get the same results in production. You actually find that as the time between events goes up, your performance can drop.
Yeah.
And that's because there'll be things like, well, threads that were, you know, working busily all the time before and nicely cached suddenly become not cached. And so on the one hand, you know, you expect to see that as you increase the load, your timings maybe get worse. But you can also see the opposite effect is that if you give it a nice steady load, you can actually get the best possible result, and that the kind of results that you see in production may not be a nice steady load.
Yeah, there's a couple of different themes on that. Certainly, we've seen. So we always want to test at load, but you also want to make sure that you can scale down. We've seen this effect not even just in low latency systems, but in other, like, you know, broader class of applications where we just couldn't scale down for one reason or another. Sometimes it had to do with JIT concerns, just not able to hit like warm up threshold or compilation thresholds,
yeah.
And other things have to do with just how data structures internally have been built. There's a whole bunch of different reasons why you've seen that. So we always say, like, you know, load, run it low, but then down. The other thing, too, is I find is that people say, okay, yeah, we're going to, like, you know, do, like, 60 transactions a second a minute. This is a round figure. So that means, like, you know, every second we're going to launch a transaction at the system. And this creates some really interesting problems, especially when you start looking at the like the queuing theory behind it. Like if you're able to clear the transaction very quickly, like within that 1 second, you know, okay, I'll use seconds here, mark a second, whatever you want, right? If you're able to clear the transaction, that transaction will go through uncontended. And it will, because of the effect of the harness, will always be uncontended. Okay, and what happens is that if you start putting some randomization in there so it looks like more like real traffic, then what you can find is that some of these requests are not going to start overlapping, and now you're going to start exposing some contention or potentially some threading bugs that are just not possible to see if you just go in at a steady clock heartbeat, steady rate. So I think randomization in this case is also a very important aspect of when you're putting load on a system, is to make sure that things are coming in some very random fashion. In one benchmark we did for one company, we got better performance numbers out of the application simply by improving the randomization in the test runs. And, you know, that's just very wrong on so many levels that we just don't want to go there.
Actually, one thing that, so not getting into the micro benchmark stuff, but we have like months or tests, like perfected, right? And we actually run this on what we call a monkey farm, so the regular stuff that's highly virtualized. And actually, well, it turns out to be interesting. It forces you to understand a bunch of things, including things that I don't want to understand, right? This whole advisor crap, I don't want to understand it. But it actually like exposed contention points, as you said, but because of the fluctuation of everything. So I found it interesting. I think it's always fun, but you discover interesting things.
That's hugely valuable. Like one of the things we did in LMAX is we made sure we built acceptance tests for every feature before we built the feature. We decided we were going to follow that process. We ended up with over 30,000 tests. We ended up with more computers running in parallel, running our tests to get our continuous integration build done as quickly as possible than we had in production. We learned so much more about performance testing from that than we did from our performance testing environment. Because everything went concurrently.
Yeah.
And it threw out all sorts of weird and interesting things. And one of the biggest things was the fact of NUMA, how pronounced it is when you churn memory a lot. And just isolating things to sockets. Like it used to be sort of 3 to 5 times improvement just by some socket isolation. It used to be shocking. And micro benchmarks aren't showing that.
Yeah.
It all ends up just local.
Yeah, they're too small to show that.
And yes, the interesting thing on benchmarks, how evil benchmarks are. SpectJet-BD, good example, how it brought in bias locking for us. Huh. So bias locking is turned on by default in all of our apps. Yet if you've got any sort of executor service in there, you have got locks are going to be contended occasionally. That's what's going to happen. You're going to take a 10% hit on the cost of every lock because that bias locking is turned on by default. And then when you get replication, you see a point the whole system on top of that. And it's just so horrible when people aren't seeing this unless they're testing that environment.
Well, actually, most people aren't seeing the bias locking replication at all because you have to have, well, right now the JVM is still part of the instrument to just expose these things. You don't actually see the effect of it. If you do happen to have some indication of it in the GC logs, you have no clue what's causing it. Mm-hmm. There's like no cause for it. It just comes in as, like application stop times, like, why? And so the first thing you do is you start guessing, okay, well, let's just turn off bias locking, right, and see if that calms it down. And if it's not bias locking, then what do you do next? Because there's really nothing else. There's really nothing else you want to turn off that will get rid of the bias locking, right? So you're going to turn off the JIT compiler because you have a bias locking problem with it, a safe point problem with it.
Yeah.
Well, there's supposed to be a report, and it's been a while since I ran it, but every time I ran it in the past, it shows you all the causes for the stop the world statement, but it was never useful, never even gave me an indication as to what the cause was, never mind where it was.
Oh, yeah, well, let's not talk about that whole garbage question a lot of times, so.
No, there's a report for stop the world causes.
Yeah, it gets pushed into GC logs, I think. As part of it.
Yeah, it will be written to it if you tell me.
Right, yeah. Anyways, that's a completely other issue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a safe pointing is not a well understood behavior, and it's extremely destructive to thread flows. Extremely disruptive. And I think it actually gets worse when you start looking at its interaction with the hypervisors, right? And that's probably what you see. There's one benchmark I run in my class, and it's really boring if everybody runs it on the same hardware. It gets really interesting when people run it on different pieces of hardware and they run it virtualized, right? So I really encourage that people come with like multiple platforms, and more platforms the better, because when you run these benchmarks, it's not only that you can learn from just running the bench itself, you can learn from having these things run on various hardware platforms and then trying to figure out, okay, what's the same, what's different, and then what is this thing actually using, and then what's different in each of these platforms that's going to cause it to behave this way here and that way over there.
So that's basically what we get from monkey farm, because
all
those things, some machines are like overcommitted, some others are not, some are bare metals, others are virtual.
But I would think in your case it'd be more important to test across a variety of processors and platforms and configurations than
We do that too,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons we virtualize so much, because we need to test across so many.
But you also need to test on bare, because the virtualization has an effect on everything else.
That triggers interesting discussion internally. Let's put it this way.
I think that's the point that you were trying to make in the very beginning, right? That things are very different on a virtualized environment. That's how App Engine gets 2 requests a second, or whatever that was.
Is our time up?
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll go then back with announcements and stuff.
Great. Thank